Hello, and welcome to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our series on Vietnam. And I think it's really important that we know that with the people in Vietnam, with the combat persons, those persons who had boots on the ground, that for every person that had boots on the ground in Vietnam, there were 23 other people behind them doing logistics, doing transportation, doing clerking, supplies, everything that it took to run a town of 250,000 people. And so when I was doing these interviews and setting these interviews up and looking at them from a personal standpoint rather than a political standpoint, one of my friends, Chris Gaynor, who we've interviewed, said, well, you've got to talk to the donut dollies. And I said, what? And he said, the donut dollies. And so then he explained to me what the donut dollies were, and I said, I will. And so he knew my next person that I'm going to interview. Her name is Cammy McCleary, and she was a donut dolly. And so with that, I'm going to give this to Cammy and let her tell you what a donut dolly is. Go for it, Cammy.
Thanks, Steve. Well, a donut dolly was a unique person. Technically, the basics were that we had to be between 21 and the upper figure we haven't quite figured out yet, 25 or 29. We had to be single. We had to have graduated from a four-year college with a BA or BS degree. We had to be willing to be, I think their key word was flexible. In other words, we rode with the situation. Whatever was happening, we took it in, we handled it, we did our very best at all times. We were unique in another way. We volunteered to go to Vietnam at a time when service there was becoming a negative rather than a positive.
So morale was low.
It could be, yes. And often was. We were to be, as Emily Strange put it, she was our poetess laureate. Emily said that we were a touch of home in a combat zone, a feeling of calm in Vietnam. And that's what we were. We went out to the field in jeeps, by truck. My favorite was my helicopter, because we always rode doors off, and I would strap in on the outer seat on either side so I could wave at any of our troops if we passed over them. And also, it gave you just a unique view of Vietnam. I've been a political science major for 2 years at Chatham College in Pittsburgh before I switched over to voice and choral conducting. So I had been filled with the academic I can't say bullshit on the radio.
No, you can't. academia.
Anyway, I could. So I had the academic side of it, and when I went there, I found out it was totally different. And that was my year from day one to, I served about 12 and a half months. And the last 2 days were spent at Tonsonut waiting for my freedom bird to go back to the world. And it was sort of interesting because by the time we left, they hadn't collected the paperwork we'd filled out. When I got home, I realized my passport still said I was in Vietnam.
Oh.
But I had all the correct stamps, so.
You might have felt like it, though, I suppose, in some
always.
Ways. Yeah. Now, I was going to say, now the Donut Dollies, is it part of Red Cross?
Yes, we are part of the American Red Cross. In World War II, we got our nickname because back then the recreation workers really did go forward with the troops in teams of two, in small mobile trucks that had been turned into kitchens. And when they stopped, they really did cook donuts in vats of oil and make coffee by the huge urn full and hand them out in the middle of the field. And no one was ever charged. I don't care what your Uncle Pete said, no one was ever charged a nickel for those supplies.
Wow.
They were just given out as a gesture that we could do that. Now, we also staffed centers back in the city. And in the centers in World War II in the cities, in like London and Paris, we were forced by the other governments to charge for some of our services because everything we had done was free. The guys from England and France were flocking to our centers instead of their own because they couldn't afford to do the same to make everything free for
sure,
them.
Sure, sure.
And then we were contracted to, we had to charge them. Anyway, that's where the Donut Dollies came from. And it's an affectionate nickname. There
yes.
were some others that weren't so affectionate, but
uh-huh.
we went with Donut Dollies. We loved
it. I like Donut Dollies, and that sounds good to me. No, okay, so let's say you get on a helicopter, two of you get on a helicopter, and you go out to a fire base.
Right.
Did you have security?
Well, usually when we were on the ground, we usually had a second lieutenant, a butter bar, to escort us around the base or something. Or we were going out by jeep. They might come and pick us up at our center. However, when we hopped on that chopper, we were as safe as we could possibly be. The chopper pilots and their crews were just the best. It's still my very favorite form of transportation. And given any chance to fly on a chopper with doors off, I'm there.
Well, it's interesting because I really do hear many, many people say, the vets that are there, I just say that they love that Huey, it was maneuverable. One of my good friends was a machine gunner on a Huey. The pilots were just absolutely top-notch quality professionals, knew what they were doing. And,
the best.
And they were also pretty vulnerable because the helicopter doesn't fly as fast. And, the best thing they could do would be to fly very low and very quickly across treetops.
Mm-hmm.
So when you, let's say you get out to one of these air bases. Fire bases. We know you pass
Steve,
out.
Forward fire bases, Steve.
Right, forward fire bases. So, they were right in the heat of the action, correct?
Could be, yes. And that happened a couple of times. We'd get there and they'd have incoming. And if we were lucky, our chopper would still be in the area and would circle around. This happened to one of my friends, and they got picked up and, taken out of there. Other times, you just ran for a bunker, any bunker. And that may be why I'm so claustrophobic now, is we spent a lot of time in bunkers. Even back near our housing areas, the VC liked to come in with some rockets and mortars about 1 a.m. on a Saturday because they knew that we'd all been partying and back in the rear, and they figured we were most vulnerable at that point. In fact, I have a picture of me in a bunker with everyone else the night of my farewell party, and what I'm wearing is a yellow towel.
You're wearing a yellow what?
All, towel.
A towel. Oh, okay. Okay. Must have been a good party.
It was. I think we drank everything, including the cherry herring or something.
Ooh. I've had cherry herring, and that would gag a maggot. It really is bad.
Yes.
So,
yes, but it was the last alcohol that we had at that point. So we drank it anyway.
Well, what was, I know, you know, like we talked about morale and just, a touch of home. And, I mean, we've all seen the letters that have come from Vietnam that have been, poignant and, homesick. And one of the things that I mentioned to you when we talked before was it just seemed like this giant hand came out of the sky and grabbed all these kids from farm fields and cities and everything and just deposited them in Vietnam, and they were homesick. They, they wanted to be by their families. What kinds of services did you, I mean, I know you did like games and bingo and, just tell me if you went out to... Tell me if you went out to one of these forward fire bases, what was your day like out there?
It would vary. Because remember, flexibility was our key word. And
right.
While we staff central back in the rear, we also had these forward runs. And sometimes, like one day, we went out from the fish factory near Saigon, and we went out in a swamp boat, and we made stops at units that were along the edge of the canal all the way, all day. And we just stopped and saw these units and spent time with them and have a few pictures of some of them setting up camp. And one of those pictures that showed up the first night that I reconnected with the 199th was of me in a swamp boat with Janet Blank, a beautiful 6-foot-tall Greek southerner with masses of dark, curly hair, and we're in the boat leaving, and the guys from EC4s of the 4th of the 12th were on the bank waving, and one of them was taking a picture, and I now have a copy of that. It was Butch Strickler, and I met him later on at the first dinner I went to, the first day I ever went to the wall. I met a guy from the 189th when I cratered at the wall and just was devastated because I didn't know any names. I had no one to say goodbye to because we saw so many people and we didn't learn their names, except a couple that we might have heard there. Everybody had nicknames, and we might have gotten a few nicknames that stuck with us, like Poncho and Red and just everything that you could think of. But anyway.
You know, that's interesting because one of the persons told me they all did have nicknames, you know.
Yes.
Doc and the professor and, everything. And they said, and some reasons to do that was so that you didn't get too close so that if something happened to them, it was a little less personal. And I talked to a gentleman who was a pilot of a medevac team, and he had to come back and help with one of the people being medevac that was bleeding really badly. And he said that he had an armband on and everything, and he said he saw the kid's last name. And that was all he really saw. And then the kid passed away. And he said he'll never forget that armband, that feeling at that time.
We were the girl back home, the mother, the sister, the friend, the fiance, the wife, even though we never performed those duties. We were everything. We were the quintessential American female. And just the guys used to say, just seeing those round eyes come off that chopper was just a lift. wow. all by itself. Now, some people like Bob Mason and Chicken Hawk, they hadn't seen an American woman in so long, they all hid in their bunks. And so the escorting officer walked the girls down the entire length of the base camp and back again, and they never saw anyone. But you can read about that in Chicken Hawk. So our job was just to be there to listen. And I was particularly attuned because my father was partially deaf. He was raised in Hell's Kitchen, and when you had problems with your ears, at that point they just removed whatever the problem was. They didn't try to fix it. So he grew up partially deaf. He became a social worker. And in World War II, he had to get into uniform. And he tried to cheat his way in, tried to get his brother to take the test, couldn't do it. So anyway, he went with Red Cross and wound up being head of Service to Military Families at Shepherd Airfield in wow. Amarillo. And that's, I grew up with World War II and Red Cross in service. And one of my father's favorite things was that my brother and I, we owed our country more than taxes.
Yeah.
And my brother became an Air Force pilot and eventually went with Delta and retired as a full captain and instructor, and gave me one of the biggest thrills of my life when he took us up on the 737 over a Thanksgiving break with full hydraulics, and we each got to fly the plane.
Wow.
And pulling up into the stars was amazing. But I digress, which I do often, and I apologize. But going back to flying the low and fast and the high and slow, one of the great things about my 23rd birthday, which occurred March 8, 1968, after Tet, but before the May offensive. And so it was my birthday. I'm going out to visit all my favorite units in the 199th. And the guys, the pilots, asked me, how do you want it, high and slow or low and fast? High and slow was where the politicians went. If it was very high, you couldn't get hit. And it was slow, so you could watch, look down, and see whatever you needed to see. And low and fast was how they flew when they needed to. So I said, low and fast, the lower, the faster, the better. So we hopped tree lines and hedges and went straight down a river with a Vietnamese village up on the bank. And we were at the eye level of the village. So we were waving. And literally, again, it was Snoopy on top of this doghouse in full flying regalia. Except
wow.
we were wearing little light blue uniforms and loafers.
Wow.
So we weren't exactly dressed to camouflage ourselves. And yet, one of our women, a unit director from Arkansas, was hit by a sniper in the hip. And she was medevaced the same way any other troop would be. And I haven't seen her since, but I just keep praying that, you know, Dusty's okay.
Yeah.
And we've met a lot for each other. I mean, it's like we knew each other, but we didn't know each other.
Right.
We knew what we were, doing. We became card sharps back in the centers because we played cards with the guys all day. So, back alley bridge and pinochle and stuff like this. It was, but out in the field, okay, if it was safe. First time I went, it was safe. We went out to see first tanks at Mud Flats in August of 67. So, Margot Looney, a beautiful black woman from East Coast, and I were out there. And we flew out in a Marine helicopter. And those things were left over from Korea, and they flew like pregnant mixed masters. They were the worst. And then because it was a hot area, we had to spiral in. So by the time I got off and this lieutenant said, Mr. Lockheed Scott, for your coffee, I just went, yes, please. And but we programmed out there because they owned 3 acres. And we had the whole group there. So we're programming and having, we had a wonderful time. We got up on the tanks, had our pictures taken, and it was such a great day. And 3 weeks later, one of the guys came in, Jerry Carroll, and he said that they had been overrun and that he was the only one who had gotten out alive and uninjured. Everybody else was gone.
Wow.
And that was the first time I had to really deal. And I'd only been in country about 3 weeks.
Wow. That's that's the kind of thing you can tell, but no one can feel it except for you.
Yeah. It's why when people say, oh, yeah, I know about Vietnam. I saw it every night on TV. No, you knew nothing about Vietnam back here in the United States, which is why the protests bothered us so much, because we knew what it was doing to the guys who were out in the field just trying to stay alive and having all this stuff come back from the United States, and they're going, did they really think we want to be here? Most of us don't. Some people were career military, and they were there because it was their permanent job, but most of the guys were just doing what their country asked them to do or told them to do, and they were trying to survive, and you were there, and you tried to stay alive for the guy next to you.
Yeah.
For your brother in arms.
I've heard that.
Very little thought of this country, but it was, and the thing about the name, yeah, because you got close to the first people you were with in basic training, and at Tigerland at Fort Polk. And when you got to Vietnam, when you first got there, you just became really tight. But then you started losing people, and it hurt.
Uh-huh.
And it, sadly, because a part of your unit, your family, was gone. And the absence was so obvious. And then as you got deeper into your tour, you know, you just protected yourself by building walls. With my PTSD, I still build walls around me of paper, of mail I haven't opened for a year, you know, of things that just, they perform a service because they keep me safe. And that's my feeling about it, and it still is. And I've been home since August 1968. Not sure when in August, but sometime in August.
Mm-hmm.
1968.
Let me ask you a question. When you went to the wall for the first time, and I've seen the wall several times myself, what was your impression?
Wow. Okay, we went on to New York for a Donut Dolly reunion. And then that Sunday, I found out everybody was going down to D.C. for a march. And this was like 1984. And so I changed my... I was living in Houston at the time with my second husband and my only child, my only son. Who, by the way, courtesy of Agent Orange, had to be cut out of me twice because he was wrapped in tumors. And I was in the baby business, automatically, instantly, whatever. But anyway, so we go down to D.C., and they sent Penny and I off to see the wall because most everyone else had already seen it. So Penny and I are standing at the top of the hill looking down at it, and she was like 70, 71, and I was 67, 68. So we knew a totally different war, totally different places, units had moved. Housing had moved. Everything was different. So we stood there looking at this huge wall, and we looked at each other and we said, piece of cake. We don't know any names on this wall, so this is going to be really easy. So wrong. We went to a kiosk. We looked at the directory. We found the time that started our time. For me, it was like the fourth week in July when I got to my unit. And for Penny, it was sometime in 1970. And Penny Evans is another Donut Dolly you should talk to. But anyway, we were looking at it, and we decided, okay, we'll split up, because this is not going to be bad, because we don't know anybody, right? So we split up. I went down to 26 East. And the first name practically that I see is I see an American Legion magazine. It's talking about a group of Marines who are doing... guard duty on a favorite bridge of one of those, we build it up, they blew it up, we build it up, they blew it up, you know, back and forth. And so they're standing guard, and one of the guys was a doc from Springfield, Massachusetts, George Gallagher. And this article was about them and the fact that the week after we'd seen them, they were overrun. And he was the first name I saw on the wall, and it was someone I knew.
Amazing.
And from there, it went downhill rapidly. I started looking at all these names and looking at the dates and thinking about where I was and what I was doing at that time. And it just overwhelmed me. I was devastated.
Yeah.
I started to cry, and I couldn't stop. And when I finally got my eyes pried them open again, I looked up and up, and I saw a 199th patch. And I was, anyway, I loved spending my time with my Marines at the beginning because I'd gone to Vietnam because of Marine amputees I'd worked with summer before my senior year in college at Philadelphia Naval Hospital. And I was a summer worker. So I was a junior and an aide and still managed to get into mischief that summer. But also I talked to the guys one day and they were telling me what it meant to see an American woman out in the field. And that sophisticated 21-year-old goes, oh, yeah, sure. And they said, no. They smile. They talk. They laugh. They wave. They're home.
Yeah.
And it meant everything to see them. So at that point, I promised myself I was going to Vietnam, but I had to graduate from college first. But a month after I graduated from college, I was in D.C. getting my training, and then on to Vietnam. And you had to do a local interview, a regional interview, and then they flew you to D.C., to Arlington, for a national, an interview at National. I mean, this was not easy. You had to go through an FBI clearance. 17-page document, you know, which was like everything but draw your feet in this area. I mean, it was everything. So we went over there, and we were contracted to the military. We weren't in the military. So no DD-214 to rescue us afterward with access to services. Some of us didn't need it all, and some of us needed desperately. And with the empathy that my father had built into me, I was one of those that felt everything and needed help. I mean, it was so, you couldn't pin down an attitude and hold it. When I got there, I was so sorry for the Vietnamese being attacked by their own countrymen. And I was up in Da Nang where a lot of our people were academics. And Christians who were North Vietnamese but had fled south in 65 when they split the country because they knew they'd die if they stayed up there. So I got to know them. Greatest people in the world. I mean, hardworking, smart as whips. And I still have the Christmas card that the guys who worked at our center made for me because those things became really important. I know I'm giving this to you in gibberish, kind of. I'm jumping from
No, it doesn't make for good. It's not gibberish at all.
Okay. So anyway, that day, I was with my Marines from the day I hit the unit until January 3rd, 1968. And then I was sent south a week at the 9th Infantry Division at Bearcat. And one of my favorite people in the world, David McTammany, who taught English at Monroe Woodbury for umpteen years, had been with the 9th, and he'd been a photojournalist. And he told me that's where I learned about a lot of the things, like the way that they would booby-trap bodies and leave them. And anyway.
Well, so Cammy, I really appreciate this, and we're going to need to talk again about this, but I'm running out of time here. You've provided me with some really, really valuable information, and I'm looking forward to those pictures you're going to send me. And I will let you know. I'm sure you have. I've been in this station, and I will let you know when this airs, and I will call you at that time. And thank you. I realize what a valuable service you guys provided. So take care and have a good day, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks.
Great. You're welcome. It was my
pleasure. To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.
Well, I'm going to leave my folder here.